USA.
The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to KUCI.org.
A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, the mining of iron has become hotly contested as fungi, bacteria, and human cells clash to reign supreme over their limited resource. A gallant galactic observer, Evelyn Hoover, has traversed space-time to report on these interactions and which side will emerge victorious on Pills, Easy-to-Swallow Stories in Medicine. This is episode 5. Hi, welcome to the show. Can you introduce yourself, Evelyn?
Hello, I'm Evelyn Hoover. I'm a first-year grad student here at UCI.
Awesome. And Evelyn, did I get that kind of cheesy intro right?
I liked it. Yeah? Very good.
Oh, awesome, awesome. I'm glad. So tell me, is it iron that everyone's after?
It is.
Okay. And why is that?
Iron's very important for all living cells in order to replicate and continue surviving and living.
Okay, so it's like a essential mineral.
Exactly, and it's present in a very limited supply inside of the human gut in this case, or just in general in the human body. We really try to limit microbes' access to this metal.
Okay. So we don't want microbes in there. And now by microbes, we mean what? Like bacteria?
Bacteria, fungi, not so much viruses. They don't really have cells to support. But bacteria and fungi, we want to limit their access, especially when we have a pathogenic situation with a lot of inflammation. We really try to keep growth down. And so we sequester this metal, preventing these bacteria and fungi from growing.
Gotcha. Okay, awesome. So like that sounds like a good setup for us to kind of talk more about it. You're listening to Pills at KUCI 88.9 FM. Each week, we look into some subject in medicine. I'm really excited because today it's the first time we're going to talk research and the kind of research that Evelyn does. And we're really excited because all of this is happening, as you said, in the human gut.
In the human gut, or we also look in the mouse gut in our model.
Okay. So, and then there's basically this race going on to see who can get more iron.
There's this large battle, this wide scale, like wow, massacre in our gut, which is
not
quite interesting. And there's a lot of dynamics that we could look at. Uh-huh. But iron is where we're focusing on right now.
I see. So it is like one way to get at the larger kind of battle for resources that's happening.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. So tell us, I think I've learned that the body uses iron for like red blood cells, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay. So that's one big need for us and iron. How do bacteria or fungi use it?
So besides the red blood cells, we also use it to replicate DNA and to do basic cellular processes. And so the bacteria also use it in this way.
I see. As do the fungi, I guess.
As do the fungi.
Okay. So everybody wants iron.
Everyone wants iron.
And why is it in short supply?
It's in short supply in our gut because we prevent it from being accessed. We secrete enzymes that bind to the free iron.
So say if you've eaten something that's got a lot of iron in it, it's going through your gut, going through the, you know, your stomach and intestines, and your body secretes things that kind of, as you said, sequester it, keep it away.
Exactly.
How does it do that?
So it secretes enzymes. There's one in particular that we're interested in called lipocalin 2, which
lipocalin
will...
Lipocalin 2. Okay.
I'll lipocalin 2, uh-huh, which will bind to the small molecules that bacteria use, which are, they're called siderophores, these small molecules that bacteria use to bring up iron.
Okay, so the bacteria have some sort of like a assembly line going to take up the iron on their own.
Pretty much.
With siderophore, you said?
With siderophores.
Okay. And this thing, what was it called again? Lipo?
Lipocalin 2.
Lipocalin 2 comes and disrupts that?
Yes. Yeah, so lipocalin 2 will bind to this molecule and prevent the bacteria from taking up their own molecule, which they produce. So it's this kind of like arms race in terms of produced molecules and enzymes.
Oh, interesting. So does lipocalin 2 have like a function apart from the bacteria, or is it made specifically to spite them?
Well, we make it when there's inflammation. So the bacteria will come in and your cells will recognize them. They'll recognize a bad guy. So in this case...
Has entered the scene.
Exactly. So in this case, salmonella. Mm-hmm. So the body says, this salmonella, that shouldn't be there, and starts secreting things called cytokines, which are just inflammatory molecules. They tell the body, you're under attack.
Okay. Right.
Defend yourself.
Rise to the challenge.
Rise to the challenge. Okay. And the body starts producing antimicrobial peptides, which are a bunch of enzymes. And one of them is lipocalin too.
I see. So now, did the inflammation happen because the bacteria was there in the first place?
No, because there's commensal bacteria. That
They're
hanging out. And the body has evolved not to respond to these bacteria.
So now we're talking about this thing that a lot of people are very interested in, right? The microbe that's in your body already. Like, so you have a lot of bacteria that's hanging out in the gut anyways, not in the cases of inflammation.
Exactly. And what we're also interested in is commensal fungi. So the commensal means that these organisms are living in concert with the host. They're not damaging you, the human or the mouse. They're just hanging out there. They're living their life as humble little bacteria or fungi.
Uh-huh. Inside of you.
Inside of you.
So there's not many of them, right?
There are actually many of them. We have definitely more bacteria and fungi even than our human cells.
So you are more fungi and bacteria than anything else?
You might be more bacteriophage, but I think that's a story for another time. But you definitely have more microbes on your body than you do human cells.
Interesting.
Or mouse cells, if you're a mouse.
Or mouse, yeah.
And so we have developed systems to ignore these commensal organisms. So they send us signals like, I come in peace.
Uh-huh.
And we say, okay,
we'll let you pass.
We'll let you pass. Yeah. As long as you don't invade, we'll let you pass.
Uh-huh.
But organisms like salmonella come in.
Those are bad guys.
And they secrete certain signals that tell the body, I'm invading and I'm a bad guy.
Right.
And the body has to respond.
Thou shalt not pass. Right.
And releases a whole arsenal of enzymes and peptides and all sorts of things to stop these bacteria.
Interesting. Okay. So now this is where that lipocalin comes in and things like that.
Yeah. So exactly. So lipocalin 2 will come in and start sequestering iron. And besides this, you create this inflammatory environment, which becomes very oxidized. So that's really cool. Because there's two forms of iron.
Okay.
Bacteria and human cells only use one form.
Uh-huh. And so you're turning it into the form that bacteria cannot use?
Yes. When you have inflammation, you turn it into the form that bacteria cannot use.
Oh.
So besides the lipocalin 2, you're forming this form of iron that the bacteria cannot use.
That seems kind of passive aggressive. Like one form is like pure aggressive, like I'm going to shut down your assembly line. And the other one is like I'm going to turn it into something you can't use.
Yeah. So, I mean, our bodies go into this overdrive mode where we just want to shut down access to nutrients.
Right.
One of them being iron.
Does this hurt the body itself? Because like you said, the body can't use that form either.
I'm sure it would if it went on long enough. Mm-hmm. Salmonella infections are generally short-lived if you're a normal, healthy adult.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I mean, you can die of a salmonella infection. But I mean, I think that's more the salmonella gets through the barrier and starts wreaking havoc on your body.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, so the body has these ways of kind of dealing with this intruder by, in a way, almost like choking off its supply of this very essential thing it needs, right?
Exactly.
Okay, but where do the fungi come in?
All right, so the fungi are also living in this environment, which is now stressed. So they're stressed.
So this is a situation where you have gotten salmonella poisoning or something.
So these guys are friendly bystanders. So
the fungi
are potentially friendly bystanders.
They're like taking a cell phone video of this all happening.
Sure. They're right next to the action. It's not a friendly place to live. So they also start secreting molecules to obtain iron.
Hmm. Okay. So because they see that this is happening and that their own supply of iron might be compromised soon.
Well, it is compromised. It's not soon. It is. Their house has been bombed.
Raided. Yeah.
Their house has been raided.
In a sense.
They now have limited access to nutrients as well because they're living in the same environment that salmonella is, in the same environment that the body is now attacking.
Right.
So they start secreting siderophores too. Different siderophores.
What were the siderophores again?
So in salmonella, you have these siderophores called enterobactin and salmochelin, and each bacteria has their own strain or their own type of siderophore.
Oh, the siderophore as in the thing that was taking the iron up into the bacteria.
Exactly.
Right?
Okay. Exactly.
Okay.
But fungi make their own. They're different.
See. Okay.
Also siderophores, but they're different. They have a different structure. And the salmonella has receptors for these siderophores.
Okay.
So under times of stress, we think that the salmonella can utilize not only its own siderophores, but also these fungal siderophores to allow them to survive better and to outcompete all of the other commensal bacteria in the body.
Oh, interesting. And so they're competing as well. You mentioned the bacteria can recognize the fungal ones?
Yes.
And then co-opt it? Or?
They can steal them. They can pirate them. We like to call it pirating.
Pirating them?
Pirating.
Oh, interesting. Because the body's, what was it? The thing the body has?
The lipocalin 2?
The lipocalin 2 does not recognize the fungal ones?
Exactly.
Ah.
So the body has evolved.
It's like a Trojan horse, right?
Sort of. I mean, it's more of the fungi are producing these to survive.
Okay. Right.
And then the bacteria are like, well, I'm getting overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Let me also steal these. I should mention that these are very expensive molecules to build.
Okay.
They take a lot of energy to build.
Mm-hmm.
And so the salmonella can build its own, but it can also steal from the fungi.
Right.
So then it won't have to build as many.
Right.
It gets to survive better because now it can devote energy to surviving oxidative stress, which the body is really punishing it with.
Yeah.
And so instead of just producing these siderophores, it can nab them from the fungi and be like, no, you don't get that iron. I will take your iron. And I will use it for myself.
In true pirate form.
In true pirate form.
Okay. That's really interesting. So what is the big question here then? How it's happening or something else?
So the question is whether or not this is happening in vivo. So we've shown it in a test tube.
Okay.
That the salmonella can utilize this siderophore.
Okay.
But we've never shown it in vivo. With a mouse.
As in,
during
inside
an infection.
The gut itself, when you're infected.
Exactly.
Is this happening or not?
Exactly. And this becomes very exciting because currently you can't actually treat a salmonella infection with antibiotics. Hmm. If it's just in the gut, if it's just a diarrheal infection, if you give an antibiotic, you'll actually increase shedding of the bacteria.
Oh, so like you make it more angry in a way.
Yes. And increase the potential for that individual to infect other individuals.
Oh, interesting.
Because they will now, instead of shedding bacteria for, say, a week, they will now shed bacteria for 2 weeks. Oh. And so they can now infect their neighbors more easily, which makes the salmonella happy. Giving antibiotics is not something you want to do in a salmonella infection unless the person has a kind of disseminated infection where the bacteria has gone everywhere in the body. And then you give antibiotics.
Okay, I see. So that method is not effective.
Exactly. So we're trying to see whether or not the fungi in the body are potentially helping the salmonella. Mm. And then maybe during an infection, you can target a different bug. You can target the fungi instead. And decrease their numbers.
Okay.
Because, I mean, they're commensal normally.
Yeah.
But in this case, they might be aiding the enemy.
Right. Unwittingly.
Unwittingly.
Yeah.
And, I mean, not to their benefit because they're losing their iron.
Right.
So they're not too happy about it. But they're potentially aiding the enemy. So we'd like to to potentially lower their numbers as well.
I feel really bad about this because, you know, they weren't really doing anything to begin with. And then the bacteria co-opts and pirates them. And then now we don't want to, like, help them. We think they're problematic. Isn't it, if these fungi were in the normal gut under normal times, living peacefully, maybe couldn't they have been helping us in some sort of way? And so getting rid of them would cause more harm?
They potentially could be, but you could also give them back after the infection. So,
okay, so
somewhat
like
a probiotic,
like an immediate kind of solution.
Yeah, I mean, after the infection's gone, perhaps you could give the fungi back. I mean, that is something to be considered.
I see. But it would be an interesting strategy for dealing with this, where, you know, antibiotics aren't working.
Yeah.
How do people usually deal with salmonella infections now?
So most of the cases don't go reported. Most people sit on the toilet. Okay. At home and deal with it.
It's a very
private moment in many people's lives. Uh-huh. But occasionally these infections do get serious enough to warrant medical treatment. And currently, if it's a very bad, purely diarrheal infection, mm-hmm. the only thing the doctor can really do is give fluids.
Just to make sure the person isn't losing too much water from
from the diarrheal.
Mm-hmm. I see. So it's not really much, it sounds like. You kind of have to just wait out for your body to respond.
A lot of it is waiting out, but you have some cases where it can potentially become a much larger issue. So for instance, in HIV patients or other immunocompromised patients that have maybe undergone organ transplant, it doesn't stay in the gut. It might stay there for a couple of days, but then it will go through the body and start wreaking havoc. And occasionally also some normal, healthy individuals with an intact immune system who are very young or very old can also have very serious complications.
I see. So some populations are more vulnerable to this kind of thing.
Exactly. So, I mean, attacking the fungi would maybe be not the first thing that you do, but for a more susceptible patient, a patient that could have very serious complications, this would be a strategy.
A potential route.
A potential route to control the infection before it becomes a major life-threatening illness.
That's right. Interesting. So how often does this kind of thing happen even? Like where, you know, on this microscopic scale on this galaxy far, far smaller, things are kind of, you know, betraying each other and like one thing is pirating another person's, you know.
I think I would say that it happens quite frequently, and I don't think that we know very much about all of these potential interactions. I mean, it's a large world inside of our gut. There's many more different types of bacteria than there are human cells in our body.
Right. And so there's like a whole ecosystem in a sense.
It's huge. It's like a jungle. It's a bacterial and fungal microbial jungle in our gut.
I see. And so I guess this is like a major area where a lot of people are looking at, right?
In
medicine for treatments of various sorts.
Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot of people are looking especially at bacterial interactions with other bacteria mm-hmm. and with a human or mouse, the host interaction with bacteria, both friendly and pathogenic, or sometimes a combination.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think that there's yet a lot of interest in fungi.
Interesting.
It was only very recently that we discovered, actually, that there were, we being the scientific community and not my lab, but we discovered that there were commensal fungi living in the gut. It was thought to be a purely pathogenic relationship that we had with our fungi.
Interesting. So that there are fungi that help us. Or maybe not help, but at least like co-live without harming us.
At least. We don't know for sure yet, but they're at least living there in a normal individual, unimmunocompromised, just a standard person.
So how do these, is it just the factor of them being so small is how they get inside of our gut? Or is it in the foods that we eat? Or how is it that these communities kind of crop up in there?
Probably a combination.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the gut is, it's inside our body, but it's also outside of our body. It's a little existential, I know.
It's a tube in a tube.
It's a tube in a tube.
Uh-huh. Okay. Right. So there is a path, but that path is long and treacherous, right?
Yeah. I mean, there is the stomach.
Right.
But
the stomach.
The stomach. But not that much needs to get through. Huh. So say you have a million copies of this bacteria in that hamburger you just ate.
Okay. That's
hamburger. Or anything.
That's a thought.
I mean, our food is not clean, nor should it be clean.
Right. Okay.
But our food is not free of microbes.
Mm-hmm.
A few will get through,
mm-hmm.
and then they multiply. And they multiply very fast.
Uh-huh.
So there's no way we could have zero.
Right. Okay. And it seems like in a lot of cases it's helpful to have this.
Exactly. In fact, you get colonized extremely early in life, and it's helpful. Mm-hmm. You get vitamin K from your bacteria and a lot of other nutrients. They break down your food for you, mm-hmm. and you get it from your mother, actually. If you were a breastfed infant,
mm-hmm.
your mother gifts you her bacteria and says, here, have some very helpful gut bacteria that will allow you to live a healthful gut life. It's important.
That's interesting. So like this is, I mean, not on a level I guess we've known about, but it's like how our bodies are communicating in a way. Like there's this whole underground level of this happening.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. That's really neat. And in the cases of when a bad bacteria comes into play, does it also disrupt the bacteria that's living there?
We talked. It does. About the it fungi. Does massively.
It does.
So, I mean, part of the danger in a salmonella infection, for instance,
mm-hmm.
is that it has developed certain mechanisms to survive when the host starts attacking.
Hmm.
Whereas the commensal bacteria don't. They're just like these little guys who are just living there. They're peaceful. They help you. They digest your food.
Right.
They give you vitamins. They're not there to be warlike. And then salmonella comes in.
Yeah.
And it's signaling to the host, hey, I'm dangerous.
It's got all these tanks and stuff.
The host starts attacking it, and the salmonella actually uses that to its advantage. It's allowing the host to clear whole swaths of gut, mm-hmm. and survive there. So it will then colonize these areas that the gut has, that the human has opened up for it.
I see.
And that's how it's able to grow.
Hmm. And does the proportion, I've heard a lot of things now with different diseases being linked to altered states of, you know, the ecosystem gets altered in terms of like the number of bacteria of some type or, you know, maybe even fungi of some type. Are we figuring out this has like a causal effect? I guess that must have been a confusing question. I guess what I'm saying is, if you have too many of one bacteria or too few, can it have kind of an effect on human health?
There is a lot of research going into this right now, and I don't know how much of it is shown a definitive link. But there is currently a lot of correlation between the types of bacteria you have, mm-hmm. and your health.
I see.
Overall health, even, not just gut health. But it is becoming known that it's incredibly critical for you to have the right proportions of good bacteria. And, I mean, what is known to be good is still up for debate.
Huh.
And it might vary from person to person, and it might also vary on what these bacteria are doing. So it might be that this one bacteria is okay now, but in a certain situation, it becomes not okay. It's a very complex situation that's
right.
Incredibly interesting.
That is very interesting. Can you, in our last few minutes, can you just tell us what got you interested in this in the first place?
In high school, I read a book called Parasite Rex, which I would definitely recommend to anyone looking for a popular science novel. And it made me realize how complicated and beautiful all of these interactions were and this coevolution.
Very nice. Just the complexity of the whole situation.
Exactly.
Very nice. We've been talking to Evelyn Hoover. She's a researcher here at UCI working in microbes. In which lab?
In Dr. Manuela Raffatelu's lab.
Awesome. And she's been talking to us about microbe wars. Stay tuned. Next up is Bear, who's going to take you to good grief. And we'll catch you next week for another episode of Pills.